Let's go in our Bibles, if you would, to Exodus chapter 17 this morning. Exodus chapter 17. We're dealing with the second half of the chapter in Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. Exodus chapter 17, beginning in verse 8, the Bible says, "Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven.' And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, 'The Lord is my banner,' saying, 'A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation.'" You know, we all love a good story. As a family, we take turns picking out which book we're going to read next. And we've read some pretty good stories. We've been fortunate to be able to find some stories. Remember back to one was a Sir Ernest Shackleton and his Antarctic trip. It was aboard the Endurance, where they got iced in down in Antarctica. We've read The Lone Survivor, the Navy SEALs team that went into Afghanistan, and Marcus Luttrell was the only one who was able to make it out alive. We've read the story of a World War II German pilot. It's called A Higher Call, World War II German pilot who helped escort an American bomber out over the German lines. A bomber that had been basically destroyed, an American bomber that this German pilot helped usher out over the lines. An amazing story. These guys met up back, I believe, in 95. We've read several G.A. Henty stories. Recently, it was my wife's turn to pick out the series that we get to read, the book. We started reading The Chronicles of Prydain. It was by Lloyd Alexander. We were beginning the series, and one of the kids, knowing it was a different kind of story, one of the kids asked, so do you like this story better than, and named another story. And of course, the answer is that each story, if it's truly a good story, it has elements that are similar to other stories that you've grown to love, you've entered into, you've walked through, you've walked down the emotional paths in your mind and imagination. But because it's its own story, there's elements that simply can't be compared with any other story. But they're meant to be enjoyed for what makes that particular story unique unto itself. So this Chronicles of Prydain have proved to be a truly engaging story with elements that rightly distinguish them as true classics. It has authentic villains that pose credible threats. It has these fledgling warriors who wage historic contests and battles. It has distinguished elders who provide that sagely wisdom that's so essential to the cause. And in the end, there's an enhanced definition of truth for new leaders and another generation of future conflicts. In fact, the only thing that this series doesn't have going for them is the fact that they're not true. They're fairy tales, or as C.S. Lewis would call them, they're myths. But emotionally, they're stories that draw you into the conflict of good versus evil, the conflict of right versus wrong, conflict of light versus darkness. As we come to this morning's text, we're given what for Israel becomes a paradigm story. It's a model story of the conflict in which they themselves are engaged. Because of the final and the perpetual curse that comes from God's mouth and is listed upon the Amalekites, Brueggemann calls this a most problematic text. In fact, he says, this text puts the God of the Bible and the Bible in some sort of conflict. If we read it from God's perspective, it's meant to take the story of the conflict and burn it upon the imaginations of the Israelites in such a way that they never forget In fact, in commanding Moses to write this down as a memorial and recite it in the ears of Joshua, God means for this story in particular to capture not just the attention, but the hearts of his people, especially the leaders of his people. You come down to the end of this, verse 14. The Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book, and I want you to recite it in the ears of Joshua. The one who just fought the battle. You'd think he wouldn't need it recited, but God makes sure that he gets it recited for him. As we come to this passage of Scripture today, I want us to see simply this, that though the war is won, there are battles that remain to be fought. It's not a profound proposition, okay? But if we don't understand that, it becomes pretty discouraging. Jesus Christ is the one who won my battle. It's under his banner that we fight. Now, we've just gotten rid of all the Egyptian army. They're floating, or they've sunk to the bottom. They're gone. They've been washed up on the shore. Now the stuff that we've been working through in the wilderness for the past 2.5 chapters have been the normal things of not enough food, not enough water, and a second time, not enough water. But now as we come to this verse, just kind of without any introduction, you hit verse 8, then all of a sudden, Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And out of the blue, they're attacked. And we find out in the book of Deuteronomy, they're attacked from behind. Sometimes as you go forward in the Christian life and you start to fight the battles, it starts to get just a little bit weary. And you think through the role that Joshua is going to play. Here is the first time that Joshua is ever introduced into the story. And he's introduced as though we already know him. And for the children of Israel, they already do, because he's won a name for himself of faithfulness in battle. And he's crowned the next leader of Israel as Moses is passing off the scene and as Moses writes this book and gives it to the children of Israel. All of Israel already knows who Joshua is. So it's kind of presumed as you come to this text that you already know who Joshua is. But as we move forward through this, I want us to see four truths regarding wilderness battles. So there's the normal stuff of just slogging through the wilderness. And we saw last time that God brings us through these wilderness trials of no food, no drink. God doesn't meet our expectations, so that he changes our appetites so that we're actually longing solely for him and not just the goodies, not just the blessings that he has to offer us. But along the way, there's actually some battles that need to be fought. And they're fought in the wilderness. Four things we want to identify this morning is, first is this. This story becomes a model because it describes for us the nature of our warfare. Look again at verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Okay, right. But let's pick this apart just a little bit. Who initiates this attack? It's Amalek, right? Amalek comes just after they've been slogging through the wilderness with no water. God gives them water from the rock, but we see in Deuteronomy that they're weary at this point. They're tired. They're languishing. Some are straggling. They're trying to keep up. They're at a low point spiritually. But the enemy comes and aggressively initiates a challenge. You know, sometimes you're walking along in your Christian life, you're just trying to follow the Lord. You're just trying to do the next right thing. And out of nowhere, boom, you're faced with a spiritual conflict. It could be as you're surfing the internet, and all of a sudden, something pops up that it came out of nowhere. You did nothing to go looking for it, and all of a sudden, it's boom, it's in your face, and where did that come from? It might be a coworker at work. You've bent over backwards trying to reach out to them, and for whatever reason, that day you just can't do anything right, and you're on their blacklist, and they're cussing you out, and they've got an attitude and a chip on their shoulder, and where did that come from? You've got these different spiritual things that just come and hit us out of nowhere. You go to the doctor, you've had everything right for the past 5 years, and all of a sudden you get back a report, and it's not exactly what you had hoped it would be. And all of a sudden, you're left just reeling. You weren't looking for anything spiritually, but the spiritual battle came and it sought you out. I think of Job as we've given the background of Job. He's doing all the right things. He goes out of his way on the mornings after his children have gotten together and enjoyed their time together, and he makes sacrifice to the Lord just in case they cursed God in their hearts. And he's bending over backward to do everything he can to make sure that his own walk and the walk of his family is right with God. And out of the blue, he's attacked, and we know that he's attacked spiritually. You know, the enemy is given to us in the book of 1 Peter as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Sometimes I think we forget it. Peter had to remind the Christians there in that book, he said, listen, don't think it's strange that this trial has come upon you. Remember, your adversary is like a roaring lion. He's seeking out. He's looking for. He's aggressively initiating conflict for you in your life, in the wilderness. A defeated foe, yes, but still a foe. We see that this is a defining conflict. This is the Amalekites. These are the sons of Esau. And they're choosing out the sons of Jacob to wage warfare. This goes back to two different peoples. The people that God has chosen versus the people that God has not chosen. It goes back further than that, Genesis chapter 6, where the people of God are countered against the children of man. It goes back further than that to Genesis 3, when God says, the seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. There's conflict. There's conflict built into the fact that you know God as your Savior. And this conflict will not stay in the background forever. But we're always blindsided by it when it comes, aren't we? Whoa, where did that come from? It came from an enemy who's aggressive in initiating the conflict. We see that the enemy strategically initiates this conflict. The first word there in verse 8 is just simply it's a conjunction. Then is the idea. When? Well, then, when they were faint, when they were weary, when they were slow, when they were weak, when they were tired, when they were thirsty, then it is that they came. Then it was when they were most vulnerable. Then, at Rephidim, the word Rephidim is the place of rest, camping place. The place where your guard is let down. Okay, everybody, we're going to camp here. Come on in, we're going to set up camp. And as everybody's making their way to this place of rest, those in the back are cut off. We don't know whether it's women and children, probably the faint, the weak, the weary, the women, the children. The enemy strategically initiates its attack. So when you get hit and you get blindsided and it feels like you weren't ready for it, it's probably because you weren't ready for it, okay? And that's the whole strategy. That's what makes the whole battle successful from the enemy's side. But not only does the enemy aggressively initiate this attack and strategically initiate it, it vigorously initiates the attack. Amalek came and fought. Amalek came to blows. Amalek came and stuck its grimy fist in the face of Israel. It came to blows. It initiated the contact, and it didn't just challenge and threaten. There was blood that was spilt. There was ground that was lost. There were lives that were lost. There was sorrow that was inflicted. The crux of the battle we find over in Deuteronomy chapter 25, where the story is just told a little bit briefly. Deuteronomy chapter 25, in verses 17 through 19, he says, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt? How he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you. He did this, it says in verse 18, because he did not fear God. Then when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget this, what they did to you back in the wilderness. The crux of the battle is this. The Amalekites did this because they did not fear the Lord. Remember how the Israelites celebrate back in chapter 15? They just get through the Red Sea. Go back there for just a second. Chapter 15, and down in verse 14. They're singing praise, they're rejoicing, and they're singing this to God, and they say, "The peoples have heard, God. They tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom are dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted. Terror, dread fall upon them because of the greatness of you. They're all as still as a stone till your people come to pass, the people that you've purchased." But the Amalekites, they asked basically the same question that Pharaoh did back in chapter 5. Who is Yahweh? What do we got to be afraid of Yahweh? These people are messing in our territory. And they were basically just nomads who roamed the desert with small flocks and probably saw that Israel was camping at one of the oases there in the deserts that they took for themselves. And though they had probably heard of the despoiling of the Egyptians at this point, they could have cared less. They sit in their heart as the fool does in Psalm chapter 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart, "There's no God. It's just these morons walking through the wilderness. We're going to do something about it." The crux of the battle is this, the fear of the Lord. It's not just the crux of the battle for the enemy. It's the crux of the battle for the Israelites as well. The fear of the Lord is basically a contest for what is the greatest reality in my life. The fear of man, the fear of the Lord. Well, for Israel, it has to be the fear of God. And that's what makes all the difference in the whole warfare. The nature of the warfare is such that there's a vicious enemy who's seeking out a conflict. Secondly, there's some requirements in our involvement. We have these fledgling warriors waging a historic contest, if you will. We're told that they must fight, but they're told not to do it alone. You see there in verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, "Joshua, choose men." Okay. This is a different kind of conflict. Back in chapter 14, God told Israel, "You be still, I'll fight for you." But here, Moses turns to Joshua and says, "Joshua, there's only one way that we can fight this, and that is, we've got to fight them. Joshua, that's your job. I want you to choose men, and I want you to fight them." Aren't you thankful? If you were Joshua, aren't you thankful that he didn't say, "Joshua, you go fight them"? He did, but he said, "Joshua, choose men to go with you and go fight them." As God brings his children into the desert, he defeats the foe, and he does it by himself. He takes care of the entire Egyptian army. But now he calls them to engage in the battle themselves. And as he calls them into this battle, it's the right time. Remember, God didn't bring them up by way of the Canaanites because he said, lest they see battle and turn around and go back. So he leads them through the wilderness for a little bit. He shows them that he's big enough to feed all their flocks and their children too. He's big enough to create manna and drop bread from heaven in the middle of the wilderness. He's able to bring them to a rock and have Moses strike it so that out of the middle of nowhere, water runs in the wilderness. What an amazing thing. And as God becomes more real to this people in the desert, they finally come to the place where they're ready to engage in the conflict. But God says, don't engage in the conflict alone. Okay. You've got an enemy. I think that's important for us. When we come to Christ, it's never just about Jesus and me. It's always about being a part of the family that God's called to himself. That's why joining in a local church is such a big deal. In fact, the New Testament knows nothing about a believer who comes to Christ who doesn't also get baptized and yoke up with a local church. The book of Hebrews, in encouraging the Christians of that day not to turn back, not to fall away, says, you know what? You need to be careful to guard that assembling of yourselves together, pushing each other forward in your love and your good works. And so much the more as you see the approach of Christ getting closer. You need what that body has to offer because you need somebody to watch your back. You need somebody to lift you up. When you get knocked down, you need somebody there to stand over you and to lift you up and to keep you in the fight so that you can keep on going. Fight, he says, but never alone. Purposefully engage others. And then be mindful of the corporate ramifications of the fight. Notice what he says there, how he says it in verse 9. Choose men for us. Moses is taking Joshua under his wings. He puts his arm around him and says, Joshua, you're going to have to fight. Now, you can't do this by yourself. You've got to do it with others. But Joshua, understand that as you go out there, we're all behind you. You're doing this for us. I think this is a really important aspect of the Christian faith. When we're out in the wilderness and we're fighting our different battles, sometimes you feel like you're isolated. Sometimes you're alone. Not necessarily all the men go out and fight. Several do. We're not told how many. The women aren't out there. The children aren't out there. Moses isn't out there, not on the field of battle. So there would be the potential for these guys out there feeling like they're all by themselves. And sometimes the Satan uses that strategy to get us to feel like, you know what? It doesn't matter if you win or lose this because you're all by yourself. You're left hung out to dry. You're isolated. You're alone. But the truth is, Joshua, you're out there fighting and you're fighting for us. You know, whether or not you win the battles that God brings into your life affects all of us. Whether you choose to engage in the battle or just roll over and play dead or roll over and give into the temptation one more time because it's just too big, why fight it? You know what? Why fight it? Because it's never just about you. It's always about how it affects others within the body as well. None of us ever sin in a vacuum. None of us ever win a victory in a vacuum, and none of us never lose a victory in a vacuum. We're always connected to each other. So Moses says, fight, but don't fight alone. He says, fight, but don't fight half-heartedly. He says, go out and fight Amalek. And the word there is the same word that was used earlier. Come to blows. Go out and sniff out the danger. Seek it out. Engage in the conflict. Don't run away from it. You're a man. Be a man. Go out on that field of battle and fight. Don't ignore any instructions. Don't invent any of your own new strategies. Look at verse 10. So Joshua did just as Moses told him. And he fought with Amalek. You know, Moses' instructions at this point carry the authority of Yahweh, the living God, who's speaking to Moses, telling Moses what to do. And as Moses tells Joshua, Joshua goes out. Joshua goes out on the field of battle and he fights. He takes up the sword and he overwhelms, it's sometimes translated, he cut down, he mowed down everybody that it was in his way. And we find out it's not just because he was such a great general. It's not because he was in the prime of his life and strong and fit and smarter than ever. It's because God was fighting for him as Moses interceded on his behalf. What an amazing thing. But he still had to get out there and fight. He didn't fight by himself, and he didn't fight half-heartedly. I think sometimes we just lose the fight just because we don't fight all the way. We kind of like the sins that we struggle with. At least we want to get rid of them, but not all the way. We're like Augustine, who said, Lord, please take my immorality away from me tomorrow. We fight this half-hearted battle. Moses says, we can't afford that, Joshua. You've got to go out and you've got to come to blows. And you've got to realize that it's either your life or theirs. And you've got to realize that if it's your life, it's also the life of your wife and your kids. It's also the life of this body. You go out and fight as though life depends on it because, in fact, life does depend on it. It's the idea in the New Testament, not becoming a stumbling block to somebody else. Don't you fall, because when you've fallen flat on your face, you know what? You're in the roadway for somebody else who's coming along behind. I'm going to trip over you. You're going to give them reason to fall too. Stay standing. Stay in the battle. Fight with all your heart. Don't invent some strategy of your own. Listen. Listen to what God says and just do it. Does it always make sense? No. Will you always understand it? No. Not a big deal. There's a verse for that. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own. Guess what? You might not understand it. Big deal. You don't have to understand it, but you have to do it. He says, fight, but never alone. Fight, but never half-heartedly. Fight, but never enviously. I like how Moses introduces this. Moses says in verse 9, Joshua, you choose out men, you go out, you fight with Amalek. Tomorrow, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make sure I'm up on that hill. What would you think if you're Joshua at that point? Man, wish I was 80 years old. Must be nice. Wish I could go up on that hill. You know what? We can't begrudge other their roles. You're out and you're in the midst of a battle. It's a battle not of your choosing. It's a battle that Satan's initiated. He's caught you by the back. He's vigorously engaged you in the conflict. And you look over at the side and you see somebody else who seems like, you know what, they just don't have it near as bad as I do. They don't have it as tough as I do. The only way that Joshua could be successful in defeating the Amalekites on that day is if he fought the battle that was given to him. What's Moses doing? You know what? It matters, but that's between Moses and God. I've got a job to do, and this is my job. I've got to do it. He didn't begrudge Moses. You know what? How about I go up there, Moses? Let me hold that rod. Why don't you get down in the battle? I can do that. No. Joshua, yours is to fight. And Moses' job is to stand on top of that hill. And in verse 12 it says, and Moses' hands in doing his job grew weary. Man, what a cushy job, holding up some rod, some staff. But you know what? As Moses did his job, an 80-year-old, and we're told in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 34 that even at the age of 120, his strength had not abated. He's engaged in a conflict. Not just because this rod gets heavy, but he's getting tired of fighting. He's getting tired of doing his job. Can you imagine if you're Moses? I can just imagine Moses, who at the age of 40, man, I'm going to kill these guys. Oh, God, let me at him. At 80, he's been tempered a little bit. But even so, he goes in, he gets feisty with Pharaoh. Pharaoh's feisty with him. And he's going back and forth, and he's getting involved. I can just imagine Moses up there on the top of the mountain. He's holding this thing saying, how come I'm stuck here holding this stick in the air? I can just imagine doing it. But you know what? Moses had a job to do. Joshua had a job to do. And for both of them, the job was difficult. It's tough when you're face to face with the warrior and your life depends on it. It's tough when you're standing up on a hill and you can't do a blessed thing other than pray. Oh, some of you are there. You'd love to be engaged in the battle for that loved one, with that loved one, but all you can do is pray. You're watching from the sidelines. And all you can do is pray. He says, fight, but never enviously. Don't begrudge others their roles. Only focus on doing your part well. And Joshua does. And verse 13 says, the result was that he overwhelmed the Amalekites. He mowed them down. Joshua did what he was supposed to do. Moses did what he was supposed to do. And who gets the glory? God. Because neither one was the most important part in the conflict. They just did what they were called to do. And God put all the pieces together. Number three. The source of our strength. Verse 9. Here we have that distinguished elder providing the essential wisdom in the battle. Moses goes up to a place of prominence. He goes up to stand on top of the hill. This means what he's about to do is a public demonstration of what exactly is at stake. Moses mounts on top of the hill and he grabs that rod and he holds it up. And everybody who sees that rod knows exactly what that rod means. They had just asked the question, you remember back in verse 7? Is the Lord among us or not? Where's God? And all of a sudden, here comes the enemy. and still echoing from the hillsides, "Where is God?" Moses stands up on the hill and he holds that rod in his hand. He says, "Any questions? Where is God? I want you to know where your God is." And he stands up in front of everybody and he holds up this rod, this symbol of authority, the staff of God, he calls it. It's a symbol of God's presence. It's a symbol of God's power, the power by which he had validated his message to Pharaoh back in chapter 7. He throws it on the ground, it becomes a serpent, and it swallows all other serpents. It's the power by which he'd performed the plagues, where he strikes the sea, he strikes the ground, and the dust itself becomes gnats. It's the power by which he parts the sea. It's the power by which he'd just brought forth water from the rock. Everybody knows, as Moses stands up on that hill, what's at stake. Is God with us or not? Everybody, look at this. I'm here to tell you, God is with you. Don't you need somebody reminding you of that when you're down on the playing field in the midst of the battle? That's why I have cheerleaders at games, for crying out loud. Rah, rah, shish, boom, bah, you can do it. Rah, rah, rah. I can't do this. Yes, you can. You can. You got to. He plays the role of a mediator. His position is a position of intercession. Verse 11, whenever Moses holds up his hand, Israel prevails. And there's some question, is he up there praying? Nobody knows, okay? There's some speculation that he was. There's no reason to think that he wasn't. Holding up your hands is often a position of prayer. In fact, when he goes out from Pharaoh, he says, "I will raise up my hands to heaven and pray for you." He's up there, he's holding up his hands. Is he praying? He's at least interceding. He's standing between the people and God and the people, and he's representing the one to the other as a mediator. It's a position, though, of weakness. His hands grow weary, get tired. So it says, whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevails. And the word that's used there is actually, whenever he rested, the enemy was winning. I think this is really important for us. You ever get tired about praying about the same old thing? You don't see any consequences. Nothing's changing, nothing's happening. So you stop praying for a while, and what happens? The enemy starts winning even more. You know what? Sometimes it feels like you're doing nothing. You're just sticking your finger in the dike. But you know what? If you don't have your finger in the dike, what happens? The dike breaks. All hell breaks loose. You've got to stay on your knees. You've got to keep plugging that hole. You've got to stay before the Lord, even when it doesn't look like it matters, because it matters. Don't get tired in it. Is it tiring? Yes. You're too old to swing a sword, but you can pray. You're too young to do anything else, but you can pray. You can watch. You can look. You can trust. You don't have time to go to a closet and pray. You're a mom with little kids. You're a dad who has so many responsibilities at work, at the office. You don't have time to go and sit and retreat and sit in a quiet place for hours at end and pray. So you swing the sword. You do what you can do and let others do what they can do. But we're in this together. It's a position of weakness. So whenever he lowers his hand, Amalek prevails. So they took a stone and they put it under him. And they sit him up on it. I said, "Listen, you can't stop doing this, Moses. You don't have a pass just because you're tired. You've got to keep going." And they prop him up, one on each side. Aaron, Hur, it's a position of meaning. It points to a spiritual reality. There's a reality taking place down on that floor of this valley. Amalek, Israel. Israel, Amalek. That's a real thing. Moses is standing up on a mountain. He's watching it. He's holding this rod in his hand. And Moses represents a reality that nobody else can see. Because on the other side of this hill, on the other side of those clouds, up there where you can't see, stands a God who oversees and controls everything that's happening on that field. He represents the God who is, and God's taken a lot of time throughout these stories to help us understand, I am who I am. I am. These other gods are not, but I am. So what's real down there on the field of battle? It's a real battle. Guess what? This real battle needs a real God. And here he is. Don't lose sight. It's a position of meaning because it points to a spiritual reality. It emphasizes a human impossibility. He can't do it. He can't be this mediator by himself. Aaron and Hur have to stand and hold his arms up. Praise God. At one point, God sends the perfect mediator who can do it, and he does it by himself. Paul reminds us there's one God and a mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. What an awesome man. It's an impossibility to do this on ourselves. But Jesus Christ stands there. It's a position that highlights the necessity of divine blessing. So his hands are steadied. They're confirmed until the going down of the sun. The whole point is that because his hands are confirmed in this representative role that he has as mediator, because his hands are confirmed, the blessing's confirmed. Guess what? That's what the whole book of Hebrews is about. You are confirmed access to the Holy of Holies because Jesus Christ stands at the right hand of the Father. His position is confirmed. Therefore, your access is confirmed. Therefore, your blessing is confirmed. A final truth about these wilderness conflicts is that there's a purpose. There's a purpose in this conflict. The first purpose we find in verse 15. The purpose is that God would be seen to be exceedingly good. As we've gone through this story, God does what he does because God is who he is. This is just one more time that God gets to do something. And as he does, we get to find out more about who this God is and how this God works. And so we see in verse 15 that Moses builds an altar. This isn't an altar for atonement. This is an altar for thanksgiving. Thanksgiving because Joshua just mowed down the enemy. God just did something. And that's all the Israelites are going to remember, God's works. But Moses connects it to God's ways. God always does what he does because he's the kind of God that he is. It commemorates all that God has done. And because this God doesn't change, this is what God has done, but it anticipates everything that God will still do. That's why it's so important for us to remember the victories of the past. It's so important for us from time to time to go back and look at the struggles that God's brought us through. Safely in the past, because what he's done for me in the past shows me the kind of God that he is for me in the future. This is so important. Why do I have to have these conflicts? So I get to know my God. That's the whole point. He names this altar. He says, God is my banner. What an awesome thing. That banner, that pole that stands in the midst of the army, around which the whole army unites, underneath which the whole army goes forward. It provides a symbol of identity, of unity. Usually on that banner, there's a symbol representing whatever legion you're in, whatever different battalion you're in. It's the one whose colors you fight under. It represents your leader, your Lord. It brings you all together. It's a symbol of identity, of unity. It provides a point of rally. It's where you go when you need instruction in the battle. You're confused, you're lost. Where do you go? You turn to your banner and you find your center and you keep moving forward. It's that which provides a symbol of encouragement and hope. As long as the banner is standing, there's still hope. When the banner's gone, all hope is gone, because those who fought with me have fallen. He says, you know what? God himself is my banner. I'm going to lose it, folks, in the midst of the battle if I take my eyes off of my banner. My banner isn't necessarily the works of God. My banner is the ways of God. It's God himself. And so it looks bad. The enemy's coming. They've taken advantage of me. They've taken hold of me. They're vigorously fighting me. Where is my God? My God's gone nowhere. I look at my banner. I keep my eyes on God. And I do what God's called me to do. I don't know what it looks like for you this week. But I know some of you have some battles that you're in the middle of. And it's so easy to keep my eyes just on the battle, just to fear the battle in front of me. I can't afford that. I put my eyes on the banner. I fear my God more than I fear the problem. And God gives me victory in the midst of it. But these battles come not just so that God is seen to be exceedingly good, and He is. But these battles come so that we can understand that evil is exceedingly evil, exceedingly bad. It's aggressive. It's strategic. It's vigorous. This conflict impinges directly upon the authority of heaven itself. We read it in Deuteronomy. They did not fear God. They were heedless of the reality of the God who is. Look at the end of this passage, verse 16. Moses says, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord!" Exclamation point. There's some difference as far as how one of those words should be translated. Should it be a hand on the banner of the Lord, a hand on the throne of the Lord, and trusting those who've worked through this far more than I could in just this week, it seems as though the right translation would be on the throne of the Lord. What's happening is the Amalekites have had the audacity not only to stick their fist in God's face, but put their hand on God's throne and to grab it for themselves. They reach out and they grab the people of God's eye. The people that God would give the Ark of the Covenant, God's throne. The people who currently possess God's presence. The people who currently bear the title of God's anointed. And God says, "I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek." In fact, this becomes such a paradigm story for them because the idea is, "I will blot out all who have the audacity to oppose me." Remember what he tells Abraham way back at the beginning? "In you, all nations shall be blessed. And I will bless those who bless you. And all who curse you, I will curse." All. Anybody who stands opposed to me, just like Amalek, will be wiped out. Is that a different kind of God than what the rest of the Bible gives us? It's exactly where the Bible leaves off in the book of Revelation. Listen, if you oppose God and you continue to oppose God and you are stuck in your ways of opposing God, God has no choice but to oppose you. As you've made yourself His opponent, God Himself makes Himself your opponent. And so He says at the end there, "The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." The nation becomes the enemy of God Himself. We see the story played out in the life of Saul. Saul, remember Amalek, wipe him out. Doesn't do it. In fact, we see in the book of Esther, good old Haman. He's the son, the grandson, the great-grandson of Agag, the Amalekite king. This story continues even through the book of Esther. This conflict is decisive. And it's meant to be both recognized and remembered. So Moses says, "Joshua, I've got to write this down. I've got to tell you again and again and again this story. I've got to remind you that there's an enemy. I've got to remind you that you've got a responsibility. I've got to remind you that God is in the battle with you. And I need you to remember that His whole purpose in this is that He might get the glory, you might receive confidence, and the enemy might be defeated." The war's won, folks, really. But there's still battles that need to be fought. Battles that have your name written on it. They're not going to look like what you anticipate. They're going to catch you from behind. They're going to hit you when you're weakest. It's just a part of the wilderness conflict. But we fight our battles with our eyes on God. Because though the circumstances change, our God doesn't. In fact, our God can't. That should be an encouragement to us. You're not in this by yourself. We're in this together. We keep our eyes on God. Let's pray.